70 years ago today, two airliners left Los Angeles within minutes of each other, bound for different cities. Neither one arrived. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. And if you have a transponder in your aircraft, if you've ever been handed a squawk code by approach control, if you've ever filed an instrument flight rules, or IFR clearance, if you've ever descended through Class Bravo airspace on your way into a major terminal, you've already been living inside the legacy of what happened over the Grand Canyon on June 30, 1956. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, June 30th, 1956, the Southwest was baking summer in Arizona, and over the high desert and the canyon country, cumulus towers had been building since early morning, the kind of big puffy clouds that look harmless from a distance, but can top out at 30 or 40,000 feet by afternoon. In the morning, they still looked benign, the kind of clouds you flew around and through, and over because they were just part of a summer day in the West. Out of Los Angeles that morning, United Airlines Flight 718 pushed back from the gate. A Douglas DC-7. If you've never spent time with a DC-7 up close, find one at a museum and give it an hour. It was the last best expression of the American piston airliner, four massive Wright Cyclone engines, propellers big enough to stand inside, moving nearly 60 people at better than 360 miles per hour, quieter inside than the earlier DC-6s, faster, longer ranged. United was proud of those airplanes. Flight 718 was bound for Chicago's Midway Airport, with 58 souls aboard. TWA Flight 2 lifted off from the same field within minutes. A Lockheed L-1049 Super Constellation. Pull up a chair. Because the Connie is one of those airplanes you just have to love. Howard Hughes had a hand in shaping it while running TWA, and what came out of Burbank was unlike anything the industry had seen. That triple tail. That sinuous, dolphin-curved fuselage that seemed to dip and rise even sitting on the ramp, like it was already dreaming of speed. Four Wright turbo compound engines, a pressurized cabin elegant in aluminum. TWA had 70 aboard, 64 passengers, and a crew of six headed east toward Kansas City. Both aircraft filed instrument flight plans. Both would spend a portion of their route in what the system called on top, above the clouds, in visual conditions, navigating by the sun and their charts and the occasional radio position fix. Now, here's where it gets interesting. In 1956, American airspace above 21,000 feet was loosely organized, to put it charitably. Controlled airspace, as we understand it today, simply did not exist up there. You had airways below that altitude. You had traffic advisories if you happened to be talking to a center. But pilots at cruise altitude in visual conditions were operating largely on what the regulations called see and avoid. The assumption, and it wasn't unreasonable for the era, was that if you could see, you could avoid. It had worked, more or less, in the lower traffic environment of the early post-war years. The problem was that commercial aviation, in 1956, was in the middle of an explosion. The airlines were carrying more passengers than ever before. Veterans had come home from the war with a taste for air travel. The economy was roaring. Routes were multiplying. And the Civil Aeronautics Administration, the CAA, the federal agency that managed civil aviation before the Federal Aviation Administration existed, was managing an airspace system designed for a much smaller traffic load, with a radar network that covered the major terminals and almost nothing in between. Over the Arizona interior, there was no radar. Your position was tracked by radio reports. You check in over a navigation fix, give your altitude and time, and a controller somewhere would move a paper strip across a board. That was the system. It worked until it didn't. Both crews may have deviated slightly to give their passengers a look at the canyon. That detail is part of the historical record in a soft way. There's evidence suggesting both flights sought a view of the canyon and the surrounding country. Company dispatchers sometimes built that into routing. The Grand Canyon from 21,000 feet on a summer morning is one of those experiences. It's cathedral country up there. The buttes, the side canyons, the Colorado River glinting a vertical mile below, it's the kind of landmark that even experienced airmen want their passengers to see. At approximately 11:21 in the morning, mountain time, both aircraft ceased to exist as flying machines. What happened in the final seconds is something the investigation could only reconstruct from debris. The United DC-7 and the TWA Constellation came together somewhere near a pair of buttes on the canyon's eastern end, Temple Butte and Chuar Butte. The collision was catastrophic and instantaneous. Both aircraft broke apart at altitude. 128 people died. Nobody on the ground witnessed it. The first indication was silence. The position reports that were supposed to come in at their scheduled times didn't come in. Controllers began working the phones, search aircraft were scrambled, and then hours later, searchers spotted the wreckage from the air, scattered across the talus slopes and cliff faces of the canyon's eastern walls. The recovery operation is one of the grimmer chapters of early aviation history. The Grand Canyon does not offer easy access to anything. The crash sites were on steep slopes and broken ledges, reachable only by foot or by helicopter in terrain that pushed both to their absolute limits. National Park Service rangers, military personnel, and civilian helicopter crews worked for days in the summer heat, at altitude in nearly inaccessible country. Many victims were never recovered. The canyon kept what it took. The Civil Aeronautics Board, the separate investigative arm, concluded that the probable cause was the inability of both crews to see and avoid each other. They were in visual conditions, but they were also maneuvering near cloud formations that may have obscured the other aircraft until the moment of impact, if either crew ever had a visual on the other at all. At crew speed, even 3 or 4 seconds of blocked visibility can close a mile of separation. The country was shaken. 128 dead. The deadliest commercial aviation accident in American history at that point. The coverage was everywhere. The search images, the names, the families. The Grand Canyon, which most Americans knew as a wonder of nature, became the backdrop for something else entirely. Congress wanted answers. More than that, Congress wanted a different system. The Civil Aeronautics Administration had been underfunded and understaffed for years, stretched thin by the post-war aviation boom and hamstrung by divided jurisdiction between itself, the investigative board and the military services over different slices of the airspace. The collision over the canyon made visible what aviation insiders had been quietly worried about for years. The system had grown faster than the infrastructure built to manage it. In August of 1957, 13 months after the collision, Congress passed the Airways Modernization Act, creating the Airways Modernization Board to begin the work of rationalizing the national airspace. And on August 23, 1958, 2 years and almost 2 months after United 718 and TWA-2 went silent over northern Arizona, President Eisenhower signed the Federal Aviation Act into law. The Federal Aviation Administration was born. The FAA absorbed the Civil Aeronautics Administration. It got a mandate, and eventually the funding to build out the radar network and the air traffic control infrastructure that would make mandatory separation at cruise altitude a reality across the entire national airspace. It took years. Some of it took decades. The controlled airspace structure we fly in today, the airways, the terminal areas that eventually became Class Bravo, the altitude reservation system, the transponder requirements, the radar handoffs from center to approach to tower, all of it traces a line back to the morning of June 30th, 1956. Here's the thing that stays with me about this. The DC-7 and the Super Constellation were, at the moment they collided, the finest long-range airliners in the world. They represented the absolute pinnacle of piston-engine commercial aviation. The Boeing 707 had not yet entered service. Pan Am had ordered jets, but the jet age for American passengers was still 2 years out. These were magnificent machines, flown by experienced crews, operated by major carriers, and they still came together in daylight over one of the most recognizable landmarks on the continent. The lesson isn't that those crews were careless. The lesson is that the system they were flying in had a structural gap. And structural gaps in aviation are exactly as dangerous as mechanical failures, more dangerous sometimes, because they're invisible until the moment they aren't. Every time a controller calls your tail number and hands you a squawk code, that gap is being filled. Every time you get a traffic call and you start scanning, that gap is being filled. Every time you descend through a crowded terminal area and the controller is stacking the arrivals and you trust that somebody is doing the geometry, that gap is being filled. It was filled because 128 people fell into the Grand Canyon 70 years ago today. I think about that sometimes when I'm talking to approach, just for a second. Primary sources today include the Civil Aeronautics Board Accident Investigation Record and the historical archives surrounding the Federal Aviation Act of 1958. Find us at radiohanger.com/taildragger. Blue skies.